It's another iSci Flyby show, and today we have a real treat. We're discussing the favourite bad guy of almost all modern sci-fi movies, artificial intelligence. From the classic 2001 A Space Odyssey onwards, rogue intelligences have been a go-to theme. Humanity generally wins in the end, but would that always be the case in real life? Our guest is Michael Ravatsos, one of the most knowledgeable and plugged-in academics in the field of artificial intelligence. He's Professor of Artificial Intelligence at Edinburgh University and, among other prestigious positions, is the Edinburgh University Lead at the Alan Turing Institute and the Director of the Bayes Centre. We were lucky enough to get an hour of his incredibly crowded schedule to talk about AI. In this first part, we talk about a range of issues, but especially whether AI could ever replace Banksy and how it can support our hard-pressed health services.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. Very exciting topic of artificial intelligence then. So of course, we need to start off with the basics and really, what do we define as artificial intelligence these days?
So that's a very interesting question and one that's been debated a lot in the past. I think generally we think of artificial intelligence as the ability of machines to do things that we would think of as requiring intelligence if humans or maybe animals performed them. So things like learning, communicating with others, using language and so on. But of course, the dial is shifting constantly. You know, maybe 100 years ago, doing simple math on a pocket calculator would have been considered hugely intelligent, and now we just think that's something quite trivial. So of course the field's evolving and our expectations are evolving with it.
Michael, when you talk about artificial intelligence these days, then how far does it actually stretch in terms of that calculator example? At one end, you have a machine which can calculate, and at the other end, presumably, you have machines that can put together algorithms to create works of art and sort of scientific experiments. And I know that aviation companies are using AI systems to help them build and design new aircraft. So, where are the boundaries?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, fundamentally, I mean, under the bonnet, of course, these algorithms are all just performing calculations one way or another. I think what's changed in recent years is that there is so much data and so much compute power that we can try to analyze a lot of data and detect patterns and also replicate patterns of kind of what humans would do in order to achieve some level of intelligent behavior. So if you think about, for example, what a self-driving car might do, that's millions of hours of training on the visual input and other parameters of the situation. And then you're trying to stay within certain kind of safety parameters while driving, while controlling the vehicle. And you can still imagine that as a gigantic calculation, except, of course, I think what's changed is this revolution of machine learning, which really enables us to almost kind of find the algorithm without programming it. So nobody would really know how to program using normal programming code to say, you know, in this situation, do this, in this other situation, do that. And we're able to derive that algorithm from the data, if you like. I think that's the big advance. But in terms of your question, in terms of the areas of life that we could apply it to, that's almost unlimited. You know, you can use similar methods to help with discovering new drugs, as you would do to design that airplane, or as we all use on a daily basis on our mobile phones to translate a piece of text or to talk to a virtual assistant who might help us with some simple tasks.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's really fascinating stuff, because it takes the whole field of human endeavor into different areas, where you potentially have a machine that can replicate or do better than a human in some circumstances. I mean, the old example always used to be chess, didn't it? If you could program a computer to beat a grandmaster, then you'd cracked it. To what extent is that a realistic comparison?
So I think there is a deeper and difficult question about what makes human intelligence and how we are unique and what all the sorts of things that involves. But I think on a kind of simpler level, we have, I think, reached a point where we can at least imagine that any problem on which you could collect sufficient amounts of data, and chess is such a problem. We can run simulations of millions of games and have as many examples as we need to allow the algorithm to detect the right strategy for different situations. In any such area, I think if we know exactly what we're looking for, you know, what winning and losing means, what diagnosing the cancer or misdiagnosing it means, then I think with sufficient computational effort and sufficient data, we could, in principle, I think for most problems, imagine a machine that behaves similarly to a human performing the same activity. Now, I'm very carefully saying behaves as if, because of course that doesn't necessarily imply anything about what it understands about the task. You know, if you think about it, the chess playing agent or program has no notion of taking pride in winning the game, or understanding whether the opponent is actually smart or whether they're whether grandmaster or a beginner. All it knows is how to select the best possible action in every step. So there is, of course, a deeper question about some of the parameters of what I've described. So, for example, as humans, is it very common that we actually know what we're trying to do? You know, we seem to be very flexible around how we manage our activities, what we get pleasure or benefits from. And also sometimes actually we get things wrong and we do things, we like doing things that are harmful. So of course we don't have that calculative mathematical notion of what it means to solve a problem. We do that sometimes. We do it at school. We do it in the workplace. But of course humans do lots of other things. And you mentioned algorithms creating art. So that's an interesting one, because that's one of those problems where when humans do that, they don't necessarily do it with a very, very specific purpose.
On the back of that, do you feel like we'll ever be at a point where AI can fully mimic humans and get the sort of nuances of sarcasm or humor or emotions in general? Like, is there any way that we can ever foresee computers generating that?
I think it's possible in principle, but I think there is a question about whether we as humans would ever agree that they do that. Just, you know, we have this attitude towards machines where we always say, well, yes, it can do this, but it can't do that. Now, if you hone in on a particular thing, so let's say the example of humor, if you train it on millions of jokes, and you know you have enough signals from humans of what they found funny and what they haven't found funny, then of course it can learn to find those things funny that humans find funny. But then we would say, well, but it doesn't really, you know, would it understand? Could it change the joke? Could it apply it to some other area? Could it maybe understand whether it's inappropriate? So I think there's a when we build machines, and I think this has always been the case, even before computers, we set up a certain kind of frame of their functionality and what they're supposed to do. We can always step outside that and say, well, there's a limit to what they can do. There's something else they can't do. But that's not kind of the engineer's way of thinking. You define the problem and just solve that problem. And in that sense, I think that for any of these problems, if we could define it really clearly, it's probably possible in principle. It may, of course, require way too many resources, and it may not be as beneficial as having a, I mean, I sort of think, for example, when it comes to creating art, we do that very much also as part of a dialogue and as part of in our culture, in our society, as part of creative people trying to express their ideas and emotions so that others can respond to it. And that's a very human process. Now, I could hang my walls with artificially generated paintings, but that wouldn't really further any further kind of interaction in society. It would just maybe give me something nice to look at.
I one of the things I was wondering about that last night, strangely enough, was if you had a very clever computer that could design art, would that compute? I mean, is one of the definitions of artificial intelligence, in fact, that computer would then spot the need for something like Banksy?
So it probably wouldn't if all it's trying to do is create an interesting or novel or nice or aesthetically appealing image. So yes, of course. I mean, unless of now, of course, you can turn that question on its head and say, well, okay, then I'm going to train an algorithm to be a Banksy. And of course, you could then do that, but that wasn't what Banksy did. He came up, or they came up, we don't know who it is really, but they came up with it with an innovative, provocative, and interesting way to do things with art. And I think that was motivated by other things that are profoundly human, politics and problems you see in society, and the need to express your ideas in a way that challenges people.
So does true intelligence require that sort of input, the political, social, cultural, historical, whatever thing that we all have in our minds because we've grown up in society and we understand our societies anyway. So does true intelligence need that rather than simply the ability to, as you say, get programmed to be Banksy? Does a true intelligence have to be Banksy?
A semblance of free thought.
So I can imagine that there will be, and I mean, I like to think about a lot of AI in terms of that we're creating certain types of intelligence that could be quite different from ours and could be useful. But I would very much agree with you in terms of that's what makes up our human intelligence. And in fact, I think sometimes there is a narrative in mathematicians, logicians, engineers, computer scientists, they think of intelligence as this really kind of rational, individual problem solving and kind of, solving very hard puzzles. In fact, most of the things that humanity has achieved, it has done collectively. I don't actually think any of us individually, or very, very few among us, are individually exceptionally intelligent to do very novel things unless they're building on what's already there, and
And
unless
that's
they're
the
pro and that's so I sort of think of humans as these kind of smart brains that sit on top of all our history and everything that's been achieved, and they play around with different things they can contribute, and sometimes something great comes out of that. And if you just think about the way we use language to think, all those concepts that we are now using, they've been transmitted to us by generations before us. And I couldn't, if I grew up in the jungle by myself, I could probably not think of a something like philosophy, being a thing, you know, that only exists because other people have, because it's a history of thought that has led to certain ideas and concepts. And now that I know philosophy is out there, that helps me think about the world in other ways. But I couldn't do that on my own.
So that's the standing on the shoulders of giants argument,
yeah.
isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
And thinking about the art then, of course, there's been some fantastic developments recently with AI-generated imagery, like the new program, I think it's DALL-E 2, which I've had the pleasure of playing around with myself. And it's quite incredible that just from a simple prompt or even just a complex prompt, it can create these pieces of art, but they all have a semblance of uncanny valley. They don't quite look right. Like, say, if it generates a human face, it looks slightly off. So do you feel like we'll ever have a point in which we won't be able to distinguish AI-generated imagery from human art? Is there any kind of way in which it may put artists in the profession out of business?
Well, I think that depends also on, you know, the expectations you have. So take as a parallel, take for example electronic music. So for a long time, electronic music created very artificial sounds that were nothing like the real sounds of real instruments. Now, with more advanced technology, we can sample, we can capture the real sound and reproduce it because we have sufficiently strong, you know, electronics and storage to create a naturalistic copy of a real sound. Now, the question, of course, is: should technology try to create to just reproduce the natural? Because people make a lot of electronic music that genuinely sounds electronic. And it's very interesting, and many people like that sort of music. So, and now for others, it's useful. I mean, I like to be able to sit in my flat where I don't have a real piano and make the sounds of a real piano because that's nice for playing piano music.
Yes.
But so I think sometimes we will want things to be like if humans created them, and sometimes we won't. But I would be actually more excited about putting these things as tools into the hands of artists.
Okay.
Because, you know, again, if you take the parallel to music, that, you know, created whole new genres of music people started making when they had new capabilities with new technology. A bigger problem, though, of course, is the problem of where it gets the ideas from. And that's kind of, you know, there's copyright and intellectual property issues there, which are about, you know, fundamentally it's used some art that was created by humans. So that's an interesting one. We see the same thing, for example, there's a very interesting AI that helps programmers by, you know, as you're trying to code, it suggests what you could write next. And that makes coding much more effective and faster. And it can also fix bugs that you might have. Now, of course, that's based on code other programmers wrote. So, you know, should we give them some credit? Or, you know, should these big AI models and tools be just a commodity that we just say, you know, we've used the collective wisdom of humanity to create them. And it can't be attributed to the person who fed into them with their human work.
That sounds like a lawyer's dream. I mean, one of the things that I read a while ago was that we'll know when AI arrives because we'll be able to talk to somebody on the phone and not know that it's a machine.
I think that's possible, but I'm not sure whether that's desirable, because one great danger, I think, is that you can, for example, you know, when you talk to people on the phone, you often talk, you know, you've missed your flight and you're talking to an airline or you're talking to your gas company, and you actually want to know that there is a responsibility and accountability structure behind the person you're talking to.
Yes.
So that, you know, they are speaking on behalf of an organization. And if you have a problem with that organization, you know, there are mechanisms to deal with those problems and have those, you know, ultimately interact with with something that is human, because that might impact on your rights and your well-being. And of course, we could easily create a semblance of somebody who understands what you want, but isn't actually going to do anything about it. I worry a little bit about that. Then that could be abused. We could have a lot of, for example, you could imagine a company gathering all the customer complaints through such a customer service, and effectively not really doing anything about them, except for the very few people who have the energy and stamina to actually write them a letter, which is then responded to by a human in an office because they know they have a legal obligation. And then their issue gets addressed. So there are risks around that. I personally think we should be very careful on a legal level, especially to make sure that people know when they are not interacting with a person.
Yeah. It's interesting in a technical or scientific point of view, though, isn't it? Where your argument there is very valid, but effectively, if the company doesn't do anything about what the AI has found, that's the company's fault and not the AI fault, isn't it? It's not about whether the AI actually works or not.
No, it isn't. It isn't. It's just a cheap way to deal with lots of problems. And again, we can see a parallel in that, quite often when you call customer service, and we know how sometimes they're outsourced to, people
other
who don't
countries,
really,
yeah.
Yes, and people who don't have actually have the authority to act. So, we can ask the opposite question, which would be, in some ways, big organizations are like big computers. They're also, in some ways, faceless and quite mechanical, at least as we perceive them. So there is, I think we need to think about how we want to interact with each other and how we want to maintain that the relationships we have in society and in business work. And whether when we introduce a bit of technology, it makes that better or worse. We've seen in big tech that, often new sort of products and services, social media and so on, they weren't introduced with any kind of malevolent intention in mind, but then dynamics emerge that create lots of harms. And that sometimes algorithms play a role in that. We can't deny that. The fact that angry or controversial content is propagated through algorithms on social media isn't necessarily the algorithm's fault, but at some point somebody didn't pay attention.
Or somebody did pay attention, but with malevolent intent.
Or just wanted to make money no matter what.
Yeah, and you can often make money from bad things much more readily than you can from good.
In terms of that human interaction with the AI, then, is there any sort of potential future for artificial intelligence healthcare, even with the NHS being so overrun as it is? Could you ever imagine an AI being able to diagnose problems or treat mental health issues, even with waiting lists being 6 months to a year in some cases?
So I think the greatest role that AI can play there is really maybe not necessarily so much about being able to do what humans do, but it's about a lot of inefficiencies. So for example, right now, one bottleneck is that whatever your symptoms, you have to be seen by a doctor before any further action can be taken. And what happened and what your current health situation is kind of invisible to the NHS until you present to a doctor. So I can think of lots of things where, for example, we could gather lots of images, sensor readings, and so on remotely. And we can triage lots of things. The AI doesn't need to make the decision whether the way your cough sounds suggests something serious, but it could, for example, help rank the different patients and then get those with the highest risk level to be seen first. So that effectively what you're getting is you get efficiencies, and you're able to use the human resources you have in the best possible way. I was talking to a colleague of mine who is an endocrinologist, and he said, you know, what happens very often is that the radiologist, after a scan, will give a first opinion and will kind of send the more difficult cases to the specialist.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, that first step could be done by an AI. You know, that person looks at the scan and looks at whether there are lumps in particular places and so on, but would never dare to diagnose because they don't have the experience and the knowledge.
Yeah.
But so you can do lots of those things. You can also do lots of things around just managing all the facilities we have. You know, there's a lot of things we can do by linking up all the data and understanding where to place which patient and who can best look after them and what things they can do. I think we will also start seeing a lot more. We need to do lots more things outside hospitals. I think one of the bottlenecks is that hospital care is scarce, and it's extremely, it has a very high cost. I would imagine, for example, that if you can do certain things in your home, I mean, especially care for the elderly, that can keep people out of the hospital. Yeah. And then we can think about more flexible ways where, you know, every now and then a nurse or a doctor goes to see them, but they can also talk to them virtually. They can also get some data about their health status remotely. I think there's a lot of efficiency gains there, because if we think about it in healthcare, I mean, the capabilities we have in healthcare nowadays are better than ever. The bottleneck is the cost.
Yeah.
You know, the,
and the
doing,
people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, doing the best possible things that we can do for every patient is just very, very expensive and labor intensive.
So you see AI, and I'm really pleased that you've got onto this subject. I mean, you see AI as being an enabler in that process. So it underpins the efficiencies of a healthcare system. Is there anywhere that you know that is already doing that?
So, I mean, there are very interesting things around diagnosis. So for example, you know, things like skin cancer or other certain types of cancers, where the human isn't necessarily is still superior to the AI, but interestingly, the combined accuracy of human plus AI is higher than either of them in isolation. And that to me is a nice way of thinking about it. We can also so I have colleagues who are working a lot on kind of essentially using a bit of AI to correct the human intervention and support it. So you know, you can imagine you know, if the incision in the operating theater isn't perfect, you could have, you know, a robotic arm supporting the surgeon. But of course, you know, that can only ever be as reliable as it needs to be for a medical context if the system is really extremely accurate on a very narrow function. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, having an actual robotic surgeon, that would be, I think, you know, 20 years away. But having a particular a function that is facilitated by a bit of AI, I think that's much more realistic.
They are talking about surgical interventions being done by robotics, and I presume that underpinning that is a certain amount of AI in terms of where to make incisions, what to do, and so on. So that is that already happening, or am I just picking up science fiction?
So I guess actually the most realistic short-term gain we will have from that is being able to do the surgery remotely. So, when you know that, my robotics colleagues, they have this notion of shared autonomy. So you are essentially remote controlling, if you can't get to the patient, what needs to be done with the Lancet on the patient. But there is a little bit, because that remote control isn't perfect, there's a little bit of intelligence at the other end, that allows you to avoid any mistakes that could be made. And of course, there, it's easier to introduce these technologies because the alternative would be that the patient does not get treated. So, we have a good safety argument to say, well, the benefits outweigh the risks. I think we need to be also very conscious of where, and I think that's a good example of a good use of our resources. I don't think, in for very specialized, very complicated surgery, that we're actually going to gain that much by investing billions into replacing one specialist heart surgeon. But I could imagine, for example, that if 10 years from now we could have robots that dress wounds, and that's something that needs to be done 10,000 times a day, that should be where we might want to be looking.
Is there any sense in which we could replicate the knowledge and skill of a very, very good surgeon and thereby multiply the effects of what you're talking about here?
I think that may be the case, but I think there is actually a different risk associated with that, which I think is economic and societal, which is that I worry that there will be a temptation to do these sorts of things before we get to the full competency, and then you sort of have a cheaper second class, second tier or lower tier, where there will be a temptation to say, well, you should rather be getting that than not getting anything in your part of the world or in your part of the country, indeed. And I think that's quite dangerous. So I think I would there are there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in healthcare. Making sure people take the, using AI to make sure people take the drugs correctly, making sure prescriptions are monitored and you can actually understand side effects that go undetected because if people have multiple diseases and they get prescribed, older people get prescribed lots of things. And there is also abuse and misuse of pharmaceuticals. And so there's a lot of things you can do really with, statistics and analysis of data and optimizing processes. There's a lot of things you can do with wearable devices. When at the moment, the risk of cardiac incidents is assessed based on one protein in your blood when you present at the hospital with chest pain. It isn't too hard to monitor lots of readings for a patient over time to be able to assess that risk much more accurately. And I think that will save a lot of lives. I'm not necessarily sure whether, as a scientist, I think a fully fledged robotic surgeon sounds like a great scientific challenge. But we need to be pragmatic, and we need to think also about what benefits society, rather than just, moonshots that are exciting for scientists.
We'll